Although the following conversation is sponsored by John Hancock, the opinions and legal views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily reflect John Hancock's views on any of the issues discussed. Please listen to the important disclosures at the end of this broadcast.
On this edition of John Hancock's Advanced Markets Radio, we will discuss plan administration for non-qualified executive benefit plans with John Harrison, Director of Advanced Markets at John Hancock Life Insurance Company, and with Tricia Morrison, Chief Operating Officer of the Pangburn Group. I'm Tanya Ittings, and you're listening to John Hancock's Advanced Markets Radio.
I would like to welcome all of our listeners to this JHAM radio broadcast about plan administration for non-qualified executive benefit plans. I'm very happy to have Tricia Morrison, Chief Operating Officer of the Pangburn Group, on the broadcast with us. Welcome, Tricia, and thank you for joining us today.
Thanks very much, John. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Tricia, we get a lot of calls here in Advanced Markets about non-qualified executive benefit plans, plans such as deferred compensation, supplemental executive retirement plans, or SERPs, 162 bonus plans, restrictive endorsement bonus arrangements, or REBAs, and split dollar plans. They're all very popular. One of the most common questions we are asked is whether or not plan administration is needed. Is there an approach that you would advise our listeners to use to determine the answer to that question for a specific situation?
Big or small plan, whether it's a private or public company, regulatory issues exist that still make administration very relevant, even more so than perhaps it used to be. Although to many plan sponsors, the calculations of a benefit plan might seem simple or easily accomplished in a spreadsheet or a simple database, all these complex laws that we now deal with that surround these types of plans affect compliance, reporting, accounting, FICA, taxation, disclosing information. So all of that still exists regardless of the size of the plan. In the past, non-qualified plans perhaps were considered simpler to handle, simpler to administer as compared to qualified plans. But as the rules governing non-qualified plans have changed, particularly since 2005 when Internal Revenue Code Section 409 Cap A was enacted, this has really created sweeping changes to our industry and required basically that we follow a set of rules that didn't exist before. What a lot of people I think don't realize, or plan sponsors don't realize, is that non-compliance of these 409A rules results in financial penalties to the participant, not the plan sponsor. So it really puts the plan sponsor in a position to have and ensure that they're following these rules and that they're getting the operations and administration right. So for all of those reasons, I'm hard-pressed to find a good reason why you shouldn't have an administrator, whether the plan has one person in it or hundreds or thousands of participants.
I agree with you 100% that the rules for these plans are extremely complex, and the one little mistake could be very significant overall to the plan participants. Now, we often find that we're told by the callers that the qualified plan administrator will administer the non-qualified arrangements. And what ends up happening in most cases is that the caller calls us back and says, oh, well, no, the qualified plan administrator really can't do the non-qualified plan administration. So these rules are very, very different from qualified plans, and it's important to have the proper administration on the non-qualified side. Tricia, what are some of the most common executive plan designs that the Pangburn Group provides administration for?
We categorize non-qualified plans in a couple of big categories. We look at defined contribution plans, defined benefit plans, and then split dollar arrangements, which may come in combination with either defined contribution or defined benefit plans, or may stand alone. Those are the three big broad categories of plans that we administer. I mean, if we look at it in terms of percentages, about 48% of the plans we handle are defined contribution nature, 38% being defined benefit, and we have about 14% with split dollar. of our defined contribution plans, of course, you can start driving down and subcategorizing those plans into how they're valued, be it based on an interest rate or based on subaccounts of a variable life product or mutual fund selections that are mirroring a 401k. So we can get into all those sorts of subcategories and their different flavors and phantom stock plans. So we administer all types of those plans, but hopefully that gives you at least a broad view of the types of designs that we see.
It does. I'm curious, how often do you see aggregate funded plans? These are plans where life insurance policies are purchased on just a few of the plan participants compared to plans where a life insurance policy is purchased on each plan participant.
Well, it's very common. It does somewhat vary based on plan design. Sometimes the design of the benefit program is going to drive which way an advisor may choose to go. For instance, in defined contribution plans or larger plans, or maybe plans where you have an uninsurable participant, you're more likely to see an aggregate approach. Maybe less common with, say, a defined benefit plan or a simple defined contribution plan that has a split dollar arrangement incorporated or associated with it. I think the natural tendency, particularly for clients or advisors who are new to deferred compensation or aren't very experienced in the non-qualified area, is to want to individually fund the plan. Very intuitive. It's easy. John's contribution may be deposited into John's policy. But because with non-qualified plans, the benefit is informally funded, meaning that the policy is really just a means to have a sinking fund to pay those obligations to the executives in the future, it's often more reasonable to look at the policies as a pool of assets as compared to a pool of liabilities. So looking at it at a much broader perspective than just an individual one-to-one ratio participant to policy. Further explanation to the advisor and client regarding the segregation of the benefits and the funding, you know, very often will result in aggregate funding being the more sensible approach.
I think you make a very important distinction there, Tricia, that regardless of whether it's aggregate funded or individual policy for individual participants, the plan benefits and how they are determined are separate from the informal funding vehicle, which, of course, in this case is the life insurance policy. And that's oftentimes a concept that many people have a hard time grasping. So I think that's a good distinction to make. Have you seen any trends in the non-qualified benefit plans used today?
Well, I would say one of the most common themes is trying to keep it simple. You know, time and time again, you know, although we talk about the complexity of these regulations, you know, non-qualified plans, there's still a need for it. There's still a desire for retention, reward, recruitment. All of those reasons for developing a plan still exist. So even for maybe a more unsophisticated client, meaning they've never had a plan before, it's still a very viable option to develop a plan as long as you have a good administrator assisting you. But keeping that plan simple, keeping the design simple, goes a long way in ensuring that the plan is operated properly. And we see a lot of clients wanting to follow that mantra, if you will. I'll give you an example. We've had clients before, as we consult on new cases being developed, where we talk about what types of contributions might you want to put in this plan. And they know they want to make an employer contribution on an annual basis. And they say, well, we might want to allow employees to defer compensation, but we're not sure. You know, in those cases, a lot of times we'll say, you know, if this is a just-in-case, let's put this feature in there just in case. Well, let's not do that just yet, because the complexities that you add when you have employee elective deferrals, it's probably not worth overcomplicating your plan at this point to include. So, you know, keeping it simple is probably one of the biggest trends. We're also seeing younger executives have different needs than maybe executives who are approaching retirement. We often see in defined contribution plans the use of scheduled withdrawals that basically are often called in-service payments. They are allowing these executives to elect in advance to receive payment of vested amounts while they're still employed. So it's a good mechanism for allowing them to maybe save for college or to purchase a new house or what have you. Flexibility that's added. And it does add some complexity, but oftentimes the need for those features outweighs, you know, the additional administrative requirements. I guess the last trend perhaps that I'm seeing is plans informally funded with IUL products, indexed universal life products. Seems like that's a hot type of insurance product in the industry, and as a result, there's a need to have plans that work well with that type of product. And typically what we see are basically employer contributory plans with an interest rate, and that tends to be a hot topic these days.
Yes, I would agree. I think we're seeing certainly a request for indexed UL and be used in more of these arrangements. I would also agree 100% with you about the idea of keeping it simple. I can't tell you how many times someone used a RIBA plan, a restrictive endorsement bonus arrangement plan, with the idea of a vesting schedule, but that ends up being more complicated than actually having done a deferred compensation arrangement. So
right.
It's easy to make things that are really designed to be simple more complicated, but in the long run, it's certainly better to make things as simple as possible. Tricia, based on your experience, what do you see today in terms of trends of plan size? You know, largest, smallest, those kinds of things.
We find that there's a misconception about plan size and non-qualified plans. You know, obviously these plans are designed for the top hat group within the company. They're intended to benefit a select group of management or highly compensated employees. Regardless of the size of your company, someone may fit into that category. So the misconception oftentimes is that it's these big, large public companies that perhaps are establishing these plans. But in fact, when we review statistics from the Department of Labor, we've learned that the average plan, or most plans rather, are under 25 participants. We, on an annual basis, access the Department of Labor's Top Hat database, which is derived as a result of filings that are required when a plan is newly established. Within 120 days of the plan's effective date, the plan sponsor has to notify the Department of Labor that it has been established. So we analyze the data in this database on an annual basis. It's been tracked since about 1975, and what I can tell you from 2014 is that 60% of the plans that were established in that year were under 4 participants. And 89% were under 25 participants. And as we look back historically, this has consistently been the trend based on these Department of Labor statistics. On average, the number of participants in a plan is around 15. I think in 2014 it was actually 11, so it was down a little bit in 2014. But that gives you a little scope on where that market is. Now, the market certainly exists in the larger plan space, and those plans are obviously going to tend to be on the larger side. But there's definitely a need and plans being established in the small to mid-sized marketplace. And I throw in a couple of fun facts for you, John. You may have guessed, but California has established the most plans and Wyoming the least. And the largest plan ever established had more than 12,500 employees. So that's just kind of giving you an idea of some of the facts that we can extrapolate from that database.
Yeah, I did not know those facts.
I should have quizzed you.
You know, the facts that you're quoting do not surprise me, because most of the time when we get requests to work on cases, I would say the average plan size is certainly less than 8. And
right.
I'm not surprised by that part of it at all. So it's a good sign. I think that's where, for the most part, that's where the real market is. If you're somebody just trying to get into this business, or if you're just occasionally going to have a case here and there, the focus should be on that smaller to mid-sized case.
Yeah, and I mean, there's certainly an opportunity for new advisors to get into this area. You know, a lot of their individual clients perhaps have small businesses, and it's a natural discussion that can exist, you know, just in the course of regular consultation with individual clients.
Absolutely. When you begin working with a new client, what are some of the challenges that you face and some of the worries that might be raised by the client as it regards planned administration?
Well, particularly in this small to mid-sized market, a lot of times I find that client really doesn't know what to worry about. These are new concepts to the client. It's a new type of plan. All they may have known is a qualified plan. So they may not know what questions to ask and what differentiates this plan from what they've historically experienced. As a result of that, a lot of education is required up front, both by the advisor and the administrator, to ensure that the company knows and can learn how to properly administer the plan from their end. You know, they've got to properly account for plan liabilities and the informal funding. They've got to be prepared to talk to their auditor about what this benefit is and how they're accruing for that future obligation. They need to ensure that payroll is set up properly, that they're taking FICA into account as amounts become vested. So it's very important, and I reiterate this again, it's very important to include a third-party administrator early on because they can assist in this education and they can assist in these questions and really more anticipating the questions that the clients don't even know to ask, really ensuring that there are no surprises after the plan has been established.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. This gets back to that issue of complexity that you raised earlier. In this case, what a client doesn't know can really hurt them if things are not done correctly. And so that's why it's critical to have the expertise of a plan administrator. Is it common for you to get involved with designing and implementing the plan, these executive benefit plans, beyond just doing the plan administration?
Absolutely. We have consultants who specialize in plan design, either to assist with a new plan design and documentation, or perhaps to consult with the client and the advisor and even their counsel throughout the design process. You know, personally, we like to get involved as early as possible when a client commits to designing a plan because we're able to provide them with assistance and operational insight. One of the best things we can offer, particularly having administered, you know, over 2,000 plans, is best practices. You know, what works, what doesn't work? You know, what are some ways that you can organize your plan and the features in the plan so that operationally it's easier for the plan sponsor? We have tools that we use in order to assist with this process. We have a plan design questionnaire. It's actually available on our website, which is a nice tool to talk you through and walk you through the elements of design options that need to be taken into account at that phase. In either case, though, whether you're newly establishing a plan design or there's an existing plan that is being taken over, implementation is certainly a huge part of it. Ensuring enrollment is done timely, ensuring that participant communications are being provided and the plan is running smoothly.
Yeah, and I can certainly understand why any plan administrator would want to be involved in the case as soon as possible to make sure that things are set up properly. How about the importance of technology these days in non-qualified plan administration, given our current environment that everything's high-tech? Do you see anything going on there?
Yes, certainly. You know, one of the key things that allows an administrator to be proactive is to have a system that's designed in compliance with the regulations. You know, for example, 409A has certain rules and restrictions regarding when payments need to be made and the timing in which those payments need to be made. So having a database system that allows you to properly track distributions is critical. It allows the administrator to be proactive in ensuring that the client pays benefits out timely. It allows the TPA to properly track enrollments and hopefully provide tools to the plan sponsor that allow them to operate their plan effectively. You know, many companies use spreadsheets or have used spreadsheets or to track plans, or perhaps they had a plan that was more run on a qualified platform than a true non-qualified software system. And those can be risky endeavors when you're not really following suit with the regulations. And technology is certainly part of aiding in the efficiency and the effectiveness of that administration.
Sure. How about for online enrollment? Do you find a lot of demand for those types of services And do clients request the ability to get plan information online?
Certainly. Online enrollment, of course, as technology is improving, is becoming more and more prevalent. In many cases, it's for practical reasons because participants are maybe scattered across the country. Some for plan design reasons. You know, the plan design is such that it's necessary to more effectively operate the plan through being able to have rules in place that don't allow participants or require participants to elect certain things. So, you know, there are still areas where companies want to utilize hard copy forms. Maybe they're all in the same office place, or maybe the advisor wants to sit down with them on an annual basis to review certain aspects of the plan. So it's still viable to do hard copy forms, but for more complex plans, for larger plans, it's definitely becoming more and more prevalent, and it's important to have a good system that prevents participants from making improper elections. You take a scheduled withdrawal, for example, or an in-service, which we talked about a little earlier, which may only allow you to choose a year that is at least 5 years from now. So an online enrollment system is going to prohibit you from choosing a date earlier than that. If you're doing it on paper, then you may be dealing with, you know, a participant who improperly elects a date that's too soon, and if the forms aren't reviewed timely, you could be beyond the deadline. So it certainly improves efficiency and allows you to adhere to the strict timelines for compliance. To your second point about participants needing and desiring to view information online, needing to see their elections for previous years, having easy access to plan information is a must for daily valued plans. Having 24/7 access to be able to view how and when they're going to be paid, how their investments are deemed investments rather, or performing is critical. And it's certainly one of the main requirements of these types of daily valued plans.
Now, in listening, it seems like 409A regs, 101J regs, come up a lot. Can you expand a little bit more about how those regulations have impacted the services that you provide for customers?
Well, they've certainly added job security for third-party administrators, John. They definitely have helped us out in that regard. But with 409A, we have a rule book now, and some might think that's a bad thing, but it's really a good thing because now we know what you can and can't do. Not say that there aren't gray areas, because there certainly are. We hope to have further clarification from the service in the future on some areas. But it's good to have a rule book. It certainly makes third-party administrators a necessity. But it has changed how administrators operate their businesses. You know, we do, on a regular basis, we provide reviews of existing plans to ensure that they're in compliance. I mean, we still, from time to time, see prospective clients who have never reviewed their plan for 409A. So we're able to assist in those areas. Administrators in general have had to tighten up processes and procedures and provide more explanation to clients about what they can and can't do. Operationally, you know, administrators used to be sometimes behind the scenes. And maybe the advisor had the primary relationship, and the advisors certainly continue to have that primary relationship in many cases. But it's become almost critical that the administrator have direct communication with the client and have also a relationship with that client. Because of the nuances and the rules, it allows us to ensure that they are, you know, meeting those requirements. And I should talk, too, to 101J. I mean, that was certainly new legislation back in 2006 that affected the way plan sponsors established life insurance policies on the lives of executives. You know, insurance companies like John Hancock have incorporated the consent requirements into application forms, so that's generally covered, the consent part of 101J. But there's also certainly the notice part, which is an annual requirement that ensures that companies are reporting to the IRS that they have insurance policies on the lives of employees. You know, I think administrators are assisting plan sponsors now to ensure that they are reporting on an annual basis, and they're assisting with that Form 8925 requirement.
Yes. And you mentioned having taking over sometimes plans that have not previously had third-party administrators working with them. What kinds of issues do you find most common in those situations?
Well, you know, sometimes astute clients may have done a great job and have administered it well and have kept good records, and we're able to just add more value. But in a lot of cases, you know, their plans may be out of compliance. You know, as I mentioned just a few moments ago, we've seen plans that have never been reviewed for 409A. The client, because they didn't have advisors involved, they didn't even know that 409A was applicable. So, you know, a lot of times we're assisting in that regard. Another thing we find oftentimes is that they didn't realize that they needed to report FICA on vested amounts. So we assist with getting that straight. Deferral elections have often been done, and they've been done timely, but the nuances of, say, a bonus election and ensuring that that occurs before the earnings period, maybe it was done before it was paid but not earned. So those are little things that once we dig in, we find oftentimes are little pitfalls maybe that have occurred in those types of plans. You know, with a defined benefit plan, we haven't talked a whole lot about defined benefit plans, but those may not be as more robust transactionally, but they have stringent accounting and ensuring that that accrued liability has been calculated properly and accounted for on their books. We look at that in great detail and ensure that that's been done properly. I would say that for some clients that advisors may have, there's an opportunity sometimes when a company has a deferred comp plan already in place, but maybe the advisor's not aware of it. So that's a great question just from a prospecting perspective. When they're dealing with other matters, you know, do you have a non-qualified plan? Has it ever been reviewed? We even have a database. I mentioned earlier we review the Department of Labor database. We have a portal on our website that advisors are welcome to utilize that allows them to look for any given filing in a state or in a zip code area. So you can see what clients or what companies, rather, have deferred compensation plans out there. Now, that doesn't mean they still have the plan, and it doesn't mean that the plan's in compliance, but that may be an opportunity to say, hey, do you have a 409A plan, and is it up to par? Do you need a review of that? Just wanted to mention that that's available as well as a great tool for determining who has deferred comp plans.
Well, thank you for mentioning that. I think it's always good for producers to ask those kinds of questions of business owners to get a full sense of the different plans that an employer might have, and that could be an opportunity for additional prospecting once they start working with the business owner. So I think that's a good point. I think you also raise a good point that there's the 409A regs and the 101J regs. Obviously, people, I think, know about them, at least are aware that they exist, but there's so many nuances to these things that it's easy to overlook something. And again, having a good plan administrator in there working with them could help to avoid problems down the road. How about nonprofit organizations, Tricia? Do you find that you provide services for them, and do they differ much from the traditional for-profit plan?
Yes, we do see a lot of non-qualified plans for nonprofit organizations. And yes, they are different. They do have nuances. You know, one of the primary areas of difference is that nonprofits have to follow yet another code section, which is 457F. Those are the types of plans we see, and the non-qualified plans we're referring to here. 457F has basically a requirement that as soon as you become vested, you're taxed. So that adds a whole new element that in some ways limits plan design opportunities. It doesn't mean that there aren't viable plan designs out there, but what it does tell me is that typically you're not going to see employee money in these plans. You're not going to see elective deferrals because you would inherently be fully vested in those amounts as they're contributed to the plan and therefore taxed. So it's really not a deferral of taxation because you're being taxed immediately. So as a result, the plans are typically all employer money. We typically see that they cliff vest on a given date and are paid out in a lump sum because on that vesting date, they're taxed. So again, most companies or most participants would not want to keep money in a plan when they've already been taxed on it. So definitely see a need for it. They're obviously going to tend to be smaller plans. It's usually one or two participants. It's generally the CEO of a nonprofit organization. So they tend to be smaller plans, but certainly a need for it. Just have to be aware that in addition to 409A, there's also a 457 requirement that has to be taken into consideration.
Patricia, this has been a very informative session. Non-qualified executive benefit plans continue to be very popular, but they are, as you've clearly laid out for us, very complicated. The 409A and 101J rules make it important that business clients carefully dot their I's and cross their T's when implementing and servicing these plans. Do you have any final thoughts for us in regards to these topics?
Sure, John. I guess I'd just reiterate what we've said several times here, and that's when you have a new plan prospect, get an administrator involved early in the design process. They can offer a lot of insight on best practices and steer the operation in a way that's going to create a successful long-term plan. I mentioned this earlier, but we do have some tools on our website, such as a plan design questionnaire. We have sample accounting reports and lots of articles and so forth. So feel free to utilize that information because there's a wealth of information there and tools that will support the establishment of this new plan. And for any existing plans, you know, again, it's an opportunity. As you address these existing plans, make sure you're asking a lot of questions. Has there been a 409A review? Have they reported FICA? Have they properly accrued a liability? Has Form 8925 been reported? Find out how they're electing deferrals. These are all opportunities to correct plans, to ensure plans are operating properly, and to give the plan sponsors the best opportunity to have a long-term successful plan.
Well, thank you very much. I hope we have the opportunity to talk again on one of these broadcasts in the future. And for all our listeners, please access our JHAM Radio Advanced Markets website for any other broadcast. Thank you.
To access more information from the Pangburn Group, go to pangburngroup.com. That's P-A-N-G-B-U-R-N group.com. If you would like to hear more about today's discussion or any of the other past topics covered by this program, go to jhamradio.com. That's jhamradio.com. I'm Tanya Ittings, and you have been listening to John Hancock's Advanced Markets Radio.
For the financial and professional use only, not for use with the public. Insurance products are issued by John Hancock's Life Insurance Company, USA, Boston, Mass., 02116, not licensed in New York, and John Hancock's Life Insurance Company of New York, Vahalia, New York, 10595. This material is for informational purposes only. Although many of the topics may involve tax, legal, or accounting issues, neither John Hancock nor any of its agents, employees, or registered representatives are in the business of offering such advice. This material is not intended or recorded to be used with and cannot be used for the purpose of avoiding any penalty that may be imposed by the Internal Revenue Service. This recorded material may have been recorded to support the promotion or marketing of the transactions or topics addressed in this recorded material. Individuals interested in these topics should consult with their own professional advisor to examine legal, tax, accounting, or financial aspects of these topics.